I'm Jim DeLang. I'm the pastor of St. Francis Lutheran Church in San Francisco. I am no expert on the homeless, but we have homeless at our door every day, several times a day, and asking for help of various kinds. Also, because of the fact that we are confronted with so much homelessness in the city generally, where our people work and so on like this in the downtown area, in the financial district, why the problem of homelessness is something that all of us who live in the city have to deal with. We did a special emphasis in February on the homeless in our congregation, and enabled some of us to get involved in learning about the problem in a little bit greater detail than we had known before. Also, we had some people from the mayor's office come out and talk to us. My remarks this morning are going to be based on two things. Hi, if you would close that, thank you. On two resources, an article by Peter Marin in Harper's Magazine that was published last year, and a book, Rachel and Her Children, by Jonathan Kozol, which is just out. There are a number of books on homelessness, but this is one that examines the situation in New York City primarily, but also work around the country. This is very readable and well done. Who are the homeless? I'd like to read a little bit of a story from Rachel and Her Children. He was a carpenter. She was a woman many people nowadays would call old-fashioned. She kept house and cared for their five children while he did construction work in New York City housing projects. Their home was an apartment in a row of neat brick buildings. She was very pretty then, and even now, worn down by months of suffering, she has a lovely, wistful look. She wears blue jeans, a yellow jersey, and a bright red ribbon in her hair. For luck, she says. But luck has not been with this family for some time. They were a happy and chaotic family then. He was proud of his acquired skills. I did carpentry. I painted. I could do wallpapering. I earned a living. We spent Sundays walking with our children at the beach. They lived near Coney Island. And that is where this story will begin. We were at the boardwalk. We were up some. We had been at Nathan's. We were eating hot dogs. He's cheerful when he recollects that afternoon. The children have long, unruly hair. They range in age from 2 to 10. They crawl all over him, exuberant and wild. Peter says that they were wearing summer clothes, shorts and sneakers. Everybody was in shorts. When they were told about the fire, they grabbed the children and ran home. Everything that they owned had been destroyed. My grandmother's china, she says, everything. And she adds, I had that book of gourmet cooking. What did the children lose? My doggie, says one child. Her kitten, born 3 days before, had also died. Peter has not had a real job since, not since the fire. I have tools. I can't replace those tools. It took me years of work. He explains he had accumulated tools for different jobs, one tool at a time. Each job would enable him to add another tool to his collection. Everything I had was in that fire. They had never turned to welfare in the 12 years since they'd met and married. A social worker helped to place them in a homeless shelter called the Martinique Hotel. When we meet, Peter is 30, Megan is 28. They have been in this hotel 2 years. She explains why they cannot get out. Welfare tells you how much you can spend for an apartment. The limit for our family is $366. Try to find a place in New York City for seven people for $366. You can't do it. I've been looking for 2 years. The city pays $3,000 monthly for the two connected rooms in which they live. She shows me the bathroom. Crumbling walls, broken tiles, the toilet doesn't work. There is a pan to catch something that's dripping from the plaster. The smell is overpowering. I don't see any way out, he says. I want to go home. Where can I go? A year later, the author says, I am in New York. In front of a Park Avenue hotel, I'm facing two panhandlers. It takes a moment before I can recall their names. They look quite different now. The panic I saw in them a year ago is gone. All five children have been taken from them. Having nothing left to lose has drained them of their desperation. The children have been scattered, placed in various foster homes. White children, Peter says, are in demand by the adoption agencies. Standing here before a beautiful hotel as evening settles in over New York, I'm reminded of the time before the fire when they had children, and she had her cookbooks, and their children had a dog and a cat. I remember the words that Peter used. We were up some. We had been at Nathan's. Although I am not a New Yorker, I know by now what Nathan's is. It's a glorified hot dog stand. The other phrase has never left my mind. Peter laughs. Up some? The laughter stops. Beneath his streetwise manner, he is not a hardened man at all. It means, he says, that we were happy. How many are homeless? The official federal government statistics say there are 350,000 homeless in the United States. But people who work with the homeless, like the U.S. Conference of Mayors, say the figure is closer to 3 million, 500,000 of whom are children. And it's not confined, homelessness isn't, to major cities like San Francisco and New York and Los Angeles and Chicago. If you have lived anywhere in a semi-large city, you know that you have homeless people. Even in places like Salem, Oregon, which is a smaller town. And I had a member of our church who took one of these passes on the Greyhound bus where you can tour the country, you know, is wherever you want to get off. And he did that for 4 months. And he said in every place in this country that he went, or all around the country, there were homeless people. The numbers are increasing at such a rapid rate that by the year 2000, that's just 12 years from now, it is estimated that 18 million people will be homeless. And the reason for that number I'll tell you a little later in the presentation. But whatever the numbers, there is general agreement with the 1987 study by the U.S. Conference of Mayors that the homeless fall into these categories. First of all, there are the veterans, most of them from the Vietnam War, and they constitute 50% of the homeless, roughly. And then there are the homeless mentally ill, most of them, many of them chronic schizophrenics, which continue to be about 1% of the population. They constitute another 20%. Of the people who are homeless. Families pauperized by the loss of the job, like Peter and Megan that you just heard about, are the fastest growing group, and they constitute now 25% of the homeless. The rest of these, the physically or chronically ill without benefits, elderly on fixed incomes that are insufficient, runaway children, most of whom have been abused, alcohol and drug abusers that aren't included in above here, immigrants, both legal and illegal immigrants who just haven't been able to make it here, and then there are the traditional hobos and transients who have chosen to be on the road and just to be that way. And these, you take these groups together, these people together, and they constitute the other 5%. So as you can see, this is where the majority of the problem is, in these three categories of who the homeless are. Why are there so many homeless? From this list, you can quickly learn two things. First, many of the homeless, before they were homeless, were people just like you and me. They they had just had something happen to them, some circumstance in their life that caused them to be homeless. And you can also learn that homelessness has its roots in various policies, events, and ways of life, which some of us are responsible for, and some of us even benefit from. We decide as a people to go to war. And we teach our young men to kill and to risk their lives and put it on the line. And years later, there are grown men on our streets as the result of that. We change with the best of intentions the laws pertaining to the mentally ill. And then, without intention, neglect to provide them with services. And the result in our streets are people who are walking around who drive us crazy with rage. We cut taxes and we prune budgets. We modernize industry and we shift the balance of trade. And the result of these actions and errors are found sleeping on our city streets. The liberals cannot blame the conservatives, although they often do. And the conservatives cannot blame the liberals, because homelessness is really the sum total of all of our dreams, our policies, our intentions, our kindnesses, our cruelties, all of it recorded in flesh on the streets. And you can learn from this list that there are, you can divide the homeless into roughly two groups: those who have homelessness, had homelessness thrust upon them, forced upon them, and those who have chosen to be homeless. Now, I understand how dangerous it is to introduce the notion of the choice of homelessness into a discussion, because that provides an excuse for being indifferent to the problem. Yet I think it is only by asking the question of choice that one can really understand certain kinds of homelessness. The fact is that many homeless are not only hapless victims, but also voluntary exiles, domestic refugees, as Peter Marin calls them. People who have turned not against life, but against us and the American way of life. They have, if you will, taken the social contract and torn it up. And they have found it, for one reason or another, that it is too hard to handle. You look at the Vietnam vets. They came back from a war that everybody wanted to forget, and including them, and they wanted to put it behind them. Most of the Vietnam veterans were able to do that, but some were not. They were traumatized by the whole experience of Vietnam and what they saw as young men. And the result is drug addiction, alcohol, and it shows up in broken marriages and so on like this, from the stress. And so they have made the choice to live on the streets. To us, it is not a very good choice, but it is the best choice that they can handle. Because the alternative is to do violence either to themselves or, as they fear the most, to others. We must learn to accept that there may indeed be people, and not only veterans, who have seen so much of our world or seen it so clearly that to live in it becomes impossible. Here, for example, is the story of Alice, who is one of 50,000 homeless people living in Los Angeles. This was set down a few months ago by a student at the University of Santa Barbara when a professor gave the students in class the assignment of going out and interviewing homeless people and hear their stories. And so one day when this student saw Alice foraging in a dumpster behind a McDonald's, he went up and started talking to her. She told me she had a pretty normal life as she grew up and eventually went to college. From there she went to Chicago to teach school. She was single and lived in a small apartment. One night after she got off the train after school, a man began to follow her to her apartment building. When she got to her door, she saw a knife and the man hovering behind her. She had no choice but to let him in. The man raped her. After that, things got steadily worse. She had a nervous breakdown. She went to a mental institution for 3 months. And when she went back to her apartment, she had found her belongings gone. The landlord had sold them to cover the rent she hadn't paid. She had no place to go and no job because the school had terminated her employment. She slipped into depression. She lived with friends until she could muster enough money for a ticket to Los Angeles. She said she no longer wanted to be a burden to her friends, and that if she had to live outside, at least Los Angeles was warmer than Chicago. It is as if she began back then to take on the mentality of a street person. She resolved herself to homelessness. She's been out west since 1980 without a home or a job. She seems happy with her best friend being her cat. But the scars of memories still haunt her, and she is running from them. Or I should say, him. Now this, in essence, is the story that one hears over and over and over again. I remember a man shouting in church one day, "What about those 1,200 men that went down in the ship?" He had been a seaman, and he had survived, and his comrades hadn't. You're struck continually in hearing these stories by something absolutely unique in American life, the absolute isolation that's involved with people who are homeless. In what other culture would there be such a breakdown of familial life or institutional life or society? We just, in an individualistic oriented kind of society like we have, why, that just seems to break down. Everything that happened to Alice, the rape, the loss of job and apartment, the breakdown, was part and parcel of a world gone radically wrong. A world for Alice no longer to be counted on, no longer worth living in. Her homelessness can be seen as flight, or failure of character, or failure of will. But it can also be seen as a mute, furious refusal, a self-imposed exile. Far less appealing to the rest of us than ordinary life, but better in her terms. In America, we like to think that everything is redeemable, that everything broken can be magically made whole again, and that what has been dirtied can be cleansed. Yes, many of the people who are on the streets can be redeemable, transformed, and rehabilitated. But there are others whose lives have been irrevocably changed, and they are irreparable. People who no longer recognize not only that they need help, but they don't want help. And experience in our world has made them only want to be left alone. They are citizens who have, in effect, torn up the social contract. How, for instance, would one go about restoring Alice's life? Go back and unravel it to where it was 10 years ago and try to rebuild it. So that's one reason why there are so many homeless. Another reason is that we have to remember the immensity of the changes that have taken place in our cities over the past 20 years. For years, whole sections of many cities were turned over to the people that we used to say were down and out. Washington Street in Minneapolis, the Bowery in New York, the Embarcadero in San Francisco, the place that is used to be called a waterfront in Seattle. In every skid road, you could find what you needed to survive: hash houses, cheap hotels, and most importantly, those occasional kinds of jobs. I remember when I was a kid, in high school, one of my jobs, my dad was in the laundry business, and one of my jobs was to take a truck and go down to the Mission, go down to Skid Row, and we had occasional jobs and pick up a few guys who wanted to work for the day. And what we did is we picked them up and we paid them in cash then at the end of the day to get this particular job done, loading a big truck or something like that. There were employment agencies that specialized in hiring day laborers. As Peter Marin says in this article in Harper's, it was not a wonderful world, but it was a world. You could survive there. But things have changed. Into this marginal world, more people poured in. In the 60s, it was the kids who made up the counterculture with drugs and dropping out. Then changes in the law loosed upon the streets hundreds of thousands of mentally ill men and women as national policy deinstitutionalized mental health care and released people into the community. In 1963, President Kennedy launched the community health revolution that emptied America's state mental hospitals when he said, "Reliance on the cold mercy of custodial isolation will be supplanted by the open warmth of community concern." But it never happened. The institutions were emptied, but the communities did not embrace the mentally ill. In 1955, that's 33 years ago, there were 560,000 mentally ill people in state hospitals. Today, there are 130,000. That means that 75% of the mentally ill were released into the community, and there were not facilities to take care of them. And whenever there was a proposal for a board and care home to be in a neighborhood, why, the neighbors rose up and protested, because not in my neighborhood, that kind of thing. In the 70s came the Vietnam veterans, many who returned home damaged. But no one wanted to hear any more bad news about the war. Everyone wanted to forget. Then in the 80s came inflation, then recession, which took its toll on the working class and even middle class men and women. And people who had never been down and out before, even entire families, began to fall into a world that they believed that they would never be forced to live in. And that was when we saw in San Francisco, in the soup kitchen line at St. Anthony's, people who had a year earlier been making $50,000 and $60,000 a year and having to stand in line to get something to eat. At the same time that this world of cheap hotels, pawn shops, and hash houses was being inundated by new inhabitants, the landscape and economy of that world was being transformed. Urban renewal was leveling acres of our inner cities to put up office buildings, old towns, and parks. The old hotels were razed. Some of us here remember well what Pioneer Square used to look like in Seattle not very long ago, and what the Embarcadero in San Francisco used to look like. In the past 10 years, for example, San Francisco lost 5,000 units of low-income housing. The casual labor market was restricted by new laws and taken over by large numbers of immigrants. The price of housing increased, and evictions increased. The mentally ill, the alcoholics, who once would drink themselves to sleep at night in their cheap hotels, were out in the street, in plain and public view. Exposed to the weather, 100 homeless people died in San Francisco on the streets last year. Let me just read a couple stories about them. At least 13 of the deaths from pneumonia, untreated diabetes, appendicitis, and hypothermia probably could have been prevented by better living conditions and medical care, said doctors who deal with the homeless. One man died in an abandoned diner near the piers, one in a cave near Ocean Beach, one in the shower room at Aquatic Park, and another in a cave below the sidewalk at the site of the old Gartland Hotel at 16th and Valencia Streets, which is about 3 blocks from where Erna lives. Others were found in underbrush, on park benches, and in the hallways of cheap hotels where they did not have a room. One died in a gutter. Some died of drug overdoses or acute alcoholism in friends' apartments. Others lay for hours or days before anyone called for help. 6 were suicides. One man, Rolando Cabrera, 40, was found by tennis players at public courts near 19th and Valencia Street one June night. The coroner's report said, earlier they thought the deceased was sleeping, but later in the evening, the automatic sprinklers came on and the deceased did not respond. So that's another reason why there are so many homeless. Another reason is U.S. government policy. Since 1980, the White House cut virtually all federal funds to build and rehabilitate low-income housing. In 1986, 25,000 units were built or rehabilitated. Under President Ford, 200,000, and under President Carter, 300,000. There has been the federal subsidy program for low-income housing. But those subsidies, and how the federal subsidy program works, it's a Title VIII or something. If you as an apartment owner own an apartment building, as our church does, for example, why, what happens then is that people who have low income can come and live there, and they pay one-fourth of their salary, one-fourth of their income for rent. And then the federal government makes up the difference with subsidy so that the landlord has an incentive. Otherwise, he could put it on the market, you see. Well, those federal subsidy programs dropped from $28 billion to $9 billion between 1981 and 1986. That's two-thirds cut. We're getting out of the housing business, period, said an HUD deputy assistant secretary in 1985 in testimony before Congress. Asked by a congressman where these people would go, he replied, "I suggest they find another place to live." And as recently as 2 weeks ago, I heard Patrick Buchanan, the former director of White House Communications in the Nixon administration, now and recently in the Reagan administration. He said this on CNN, the cable news network. He said, this is a direct quote, "There are only 300,000 homeless in the United States, concentrated in a few cities. That there are 50,000 homeless in Los Angeles is not Ronald Reagan's problem. That's Mayor Tom Bradley's problem." So that's another reason that there are so many homeless, government policy. But it's not the only reason, as we pointed out. Another reason is the elimination of jobs in whole industries. 2 million jobs in steel, textiles, and other industries have disappeared each year since 1979. That's 18 million jobs in textiles, steel, and other industries. Now, it's true that new jobs have been created, and the president is often saying is that, you know, all of these jobs are created, but most of them are minimum wage jobs. And let me just read something to you from this book, Rachel and Her Children. In a depressed industrial town in Pennsylvania, Lutheran church leaders spoke of the loss of several hundred jobs as truck and auto manufacturer left the area and families saw their savings dwindle and their unemployment benefits and pensions disappear. While at the same time, rents rose, food prices climbed, and federal benefits declined. "Yes, there are new jobs," a minister said. "There's a new McDonald's and a Burger King. You can take home $450 in a month from jobs like that. That might barely pay the rent. What do you do if somebody gets sick? What do you do for food and clothes? These may be good jobs for a teenager. Can you ask a 30-year-old man who's worked for General Motors since he was 18 to keep his wife and kids alive on jobs like that? There are jobs cleaning rooms in the hotel you're staying at. Can you expect a single mother with three kids to hold her life together with that kind of work? All you hear about these days are so-called service jobs. It makes me wonder where America is going. If we aren't producing anything of value, will we keep our nation going on hamburger stands? Who is all this service for if no one's got a real job making something of real worth?" In Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Texas, this is the authors that's saying this, I met heads of families who had been only a year or two before owners of farms, employees of petroleum firms, shopkeepers who supplied the farmers and the oil workers. They had lost their farms, their jobs, their stores. Bankers in Oklahoma City spoke about the rising number of foreclosures. Oil and agriculture, those are everything for people here. Both are dying. Where will these people go after their farms are boarded and their restaurants and barbershops and hardware stores have been shut down? The answers were seen in Phoenix and Los Angeles. Of some counties in which unemployment caused by the declining lumber industry had climbed above 30%. Where did the lumber workers go? I met some of them the same night in a homeless shelter by the Burnside Bridge. A pregnant woman and her husband spoke to me while waiting for the soup line to be formed. We had good work until last year. Since then, we've had no home. Our kids were put in foster care. They had been sleeping on a plywood plank supported by the girders of the bridge. The traffic was 2 feet above their heads. Okay, what is our response to the homeless? The off-the-wall responses that I have made and that I hear from many people until I studied this issue were explanations which are very familiar, I'm sure. The breakdown of the family, drugs, lack of planning, culture of poverty, teenage pregnancy, the underclass who have been left behind by the civil rights movement, and the economic boom. While these are factors that thrust people into marginal situations, these people are not the cause of homelessness. The reason we have homelessness is very simply that we don't have enough homes. We don't have enough housing to house our population. It's that simple. And in San Francisco, we have seen it, is that where people in the middle class have to shell out more and a higher and higher percentage of their income for housing. And elderly people have found that out. If you bought your house many years ago, you know, like my mother has lived in our family home, and it's all paid for. If she couldn't take care of her home anymore and she had to go out and rent an apartment, the cost of living would skyrocket. She couldn't really afford to live in an apartment in the neighborhood where she lives with her home. And when people are out on the street with no place to live, well, put yourself in that situation and imagine the questions that immediately come into your mind. Where am I going to go to the bathroom? Where am I going to take a shower? Where am I going to put my clothes? Where am I going to make my breakfast? Where am I going to brush my teeth? And if you've ever had the experience of traveling and going to a city and going to your hotel and they say, hey, I have a reservation. They say, hey, we never heard of you. You know, there's that moment of panic, of being in an unfamiliar place with no place to stay, until you say, well, I'll just take my Visa card and go to the hotel down the street. What is our reaction to the homeless? I am about to be heartless, wrote a columnist in Newsweek recently. And this is a direct quote. There are people living on the streets, turning sidewalks into dormitories. They are a nightmare. They have to go. And the author notes that his taxes are paying for the paving and the cleaning of those streets and sidewalks. That makes me a landlord. They have got to go, he says. But our reaction to the homeless is fed by a complex set of cultural attitudes, habits of thoughts, and fantasies and fears that are so familiar to us they become like second nature. The homeless embody all that you and I and our parents and grandparents have tried to eradicate and destroy. Here, for instance, is part of a college paper. A college student wrote about her first visit to the rescue mission on Skid Row. The sermon began. The room was stuffy and smelly. The mixture of body odors and cooking was nauseating. I remember thinking, how can these people share this facility? They must be repulsed by each other. They had strange habits and bad dispositions. They were a group of dirty, weird people to me. When it was over, I ran to my car, went home, and took a shower. I felt extremely dirty. Through the rest of the day, I would get flashes of that disgusting smell. As Peter Marin puts it in his article in Harper's Magazine, the homeless to us are worse than garbage. They are shit. And what happens to us when we see them, our spontaneous sense of disgust and horror, our attitudes toward them, we wish to be rid of them, and all of it, he says, has hidden in it, close to its heart, our feelings about excrement. And he says, this is what is hidden behind every policy and every plan to help the homeless, and why it often so often does more harm than good. Every government program, every handout by you and me, almost every charitable response by churches is geared as much to the needs of those giving help as it is to the needs of the homeless. We want the homeless out of sight, where we don't have to look at them, deal with them, or smell them. So what we want to do with the homeless is the same thing that we do with excrement, is flush it down the toilet as quickly as possible and get rid of it. I have all the visions that I told my children and my mother told me when I was putting them through toilet training about how icky this was, and that they had to learn how to get rid of it. That's why if you are a homeless person, you can go to any government agency, or for that matter to most private charities, and you will find yourself enmeshed at once in a bureaucracy so tangled, so oppressive, and confronted with so much moral arrogance and contempt that you'll be driven back out into the street for relief. How many of you have seen Lily Tomlin's play Looking for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, or read the book? Seen that? Jane Wagner, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe. Well, anyway, one of Lily Tomlin's characters is Trudy, a bag lady, who wears an umbrella hat so she can communicate, so which she uses as a satellite to communicate with her space chums, as she calls them. And she says a beautiful line. She says, studies have shown, my studies have shown, that reality is the greatest cause of stress among those who are forced to deal with it. She says, I could take reality in small doses, but as a lifestyle, I find it too confining. and that's the kind of thing you meet with some of these. Okay, why is the problem going to get worse? 10 million families are living on the edge right now, because they are paying more than half of their income for housing. 4.7 million are paying more than 60% of their income for housing. Now, this includes not only apartment dwellers, but also people who have homes, mortgaged homes.
Excuse me, are we just talking in America?
Just the United States, right. You know, all we have to do is have a moderate increase in food, like we did a few years ago, and this drought is probably going to bring that on, and these people are going to be pushed out. They won't be able to handle it, they'll have to foreclose. The other reason that the problem is going to increase is that over the next 10 years, more than 500,000 low and moderate income families may be ousted from federally subsidized apartments that were built in the 1960s and 1970s. And the reason for that is that back then the government made deals with the developers that they built these apartments and made them available for low income housing for 20 years. Then after 20 years, they could put these apartments back on the market. Now that's coming due. A California legislator estimates that 70,000 apartments in California may be subject to conversion for this reason over the next 10 years. And the Congressional Budget Office says that 57% of low-income housing in two federal programs are potentially eligible for conversion. So that's why we're talking about 18 million homeless by the year 2000. In a world better than ours, we imagine that homeless men, women, and children do not exist. Doctrinaire conservatives seem to have no trouble imagining a society so well disciplined in morals and moral that things like homelessness would just disappear. Doctrinaire leftists envision a world so just, so generous, so egalitarian that homelessness would just vanish along with all other iniquities. But neither a conservative revolution nor a workers' paradise is on the horizon. And few of us believe that either would solve these problems. Meanwhile, we are not only appalled by what is happening to the homeless, we are really appalled by what is happening to us. The city with its army of grape dwellers is a school for callousness. One's natural instincts to help are suppressed every day. Moreover, they have to be suppressed if one is to function. 30 years ago, if you saw a person lying helpless in the street, you went over and helped them. Now you step over them. They live there. Trying to get a homeless person out of his cardboard box is not a simple act of mercy of which most people are quite capable. It is a major act of social work that only the professional and the saintly can be expected to undertake. Charles Krauthammer wrote recently in the New Republic, "To expect saintliness of the ordinary citizen is bad social policy. Further, to expose us hourly to a wretchedness far beyond our power to remedy is to make moral insensitivity a requirement for daily living. Society must not leave the ordinary citizen with no alternative between ignoring the homeless and playing Mother Teresa. The civilized society ought to offer its people some communal act that lies somewhere in between, such as contributing to the public treasury to build housing and a system to care for these people. Jesus said, I was hungry and you fed me, naked and you clothed me, a stranger and you took me in. I believe that there is not a person in the Christian church who does not want to respond. But how? With some change in a dirty palm? With breastfeeding? With accusations to government? To the homeless themselves? Such a response will only make us feel better for a few moments. Because you can give a homeless person some money, and half a block later, you run into another one. And another. And another. I believe it is going to require a major coordinated effort of lobbying and volunteerism and tax money from all of us. There's a tremendous amount of forgiveness required here. Whether there is even reason to forgive the homeless for their problems is not debatable. The truth is, though, that we non-homeless do blame them, and they blame themselves. But having gotten past blaming the victims, we blame ourselves, we blame government, we blame Ronald Reagan. But as we know, the burden of guilt, whether pointed at ourselves or at others, is just that, a burden. And a burden is always capable of keeping us from moving. I think we Christians have something going for us in that we have learned how to handle the burden of guilt and not be paralyzed by it. We bring that burden along with all other burdens to Christ, who carries it to the cross. But with forgiveness comes not only freedom, but also discipleship. And there are some specific things in the realm of discipleship that I believe, and listening to the homeless people who are advocates for the homeless, say that we can do. We need to work hand in hand with those who are working with the homeless, organizations like Catholic Charities and Lutheran Social Services, and other advocate organizations. Secondly, for some homeless, especially families, like Peter and Megan, we only have to read their stories backward and try to get them back to the place where things started to fall apart, and with a little help, get them on their feet again. One thing homeless people cannot do is apply for a job, because when you apply for a job, you have to give them your address, and you have to give them your phone number, and you can't tell them, well, I don't have a place. So one of the things that we can do is that we can tell a homeless person to put our address and our telephone number on their job application, and then at a prearranged time, we call them on a payphone and give them their messages so that they can call their employers. It's a way of sort of circumventing the game. Or, if we are really generous, they can use our phone. If we have room in our homes, we can, with careful screening, not by ourselves alone, but by a responsible agency, take in a homeless family. But all of this is not going to address the basic problem, the lack of affordable housing. That is going to require a massive and aggressive initiative by federal and local government, or else we will indeed have 18 million homeless by the year 2000 in the richest country in the world. And somebody has to pay for that. And it's the working middle class, like you and me, we're going to have to pay for that in the way of higher taxes, or else we could scrap a few weapon systems and decide not to build a couple of multi-million-dollar Trident submarines. Okay, this concludes my presentation. We've got about 20 minutes for questions. Isn't it 12 o'clock that we eat?
10-2.
Okay, we've got about 12, 15 minutes.
Jenna was still at work when you started. I'm wondering, where did you get the figures that you put up for the percentage?
These numbers, this comes from the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And it's appeared in a number of publications. It was the figures, the ones that I got out of were out of both Rachel and her children, this book, and also in this article by Peter Marin, who wrote an article on Harper's, and he's also doing a book on homelessness. It might be out, but he is somewhat of an authority in the area because he lived as a homeless person once himself, by choice, when he was a young man. Yes?
I'm kind of unclear on what you're really blaming the problem of homelessness on. Are you blaming it on general public policy or the whole capitalist economic system?
Well, it's just a variety of things. I mean, it's not any one cause. See, that's what I try to point out. Why are so many homeless? One reason is the Vietnam War and the veterans who are damaged, perhaps permanently. Another reason is that we emptied the state psychiatric hospitals with the idea of home care. Another reason is that the economic system in our country is the job situation in our country is changing, and that industries where people had worked for years and years are no longer operative. I'm a pastor. Mm-hmm. What if the church should all of a sudden shut down? I mean, I'm just being ridiculous. I'm 54 years old. What would I do for a living?
No, so, I understand that, yeah. See, but I don't see those as being the causes of homelessness. I see those as ways for people to get thrust into that mold.
Yeah, and that's what I said. And the reason, this is how that happened. But the major reason is that we do not have enough housing. Were you here when I said that?
Yeah, but I disagree with that too. There's plenty of housing out there. It's just not accessible to people. And
I said affordable housing.
Yeah.
Affordable housing. Yeah.
Because I think that our society, I mean, it's beneficial to our society almost to have homeless people on the streets because it keeps a ready-made market of cheap labor there.
Most of the homeless people are not even available for cheap labor.
Right, I understand that, but I mean, that's like a lower level, but I think it's a lot of economics within our society that we don't take care of our people, and like this whole thing with the foreclosure right now, the 60-day notice for shutting down factories that's being put on for the primaries, you see that the people who are in power right now are really pushing to not have that brought up because, I mean, that in itself causes a lot of homelessness, and I mean, it seems that this whole thing is tied in with our system.
Maybe what you're saying is the socioeconomic system is what causes these things to happen, and then it just keeps tripping down.
I'm sure there's other countries that have these same wars going on in mentally ill people, but they don't have homeless people on the streets. They have systems to take care of their people, and we don't do that.
So we have to socialize our policies.
Mm-hmm. We have to change.
Yes.
I really agreed with one comment you made, too, about the fact that our society is so fragmented. You know, you think about this woman that was raped, and I don't know, you didn't mention if she had family nearby, but, you know, a lot of people live in isolation from their families. And I can think of my husband's brother. He would have been homeless if it wasn't in his family. You know, he was unemployed for like 2 years, and you know, in his 30s, if he didn't have a family to fall back on, he could have very easily been one of those statistics. And it, you know, it really hits home when you see it that closely, and how what a fine line there is, you know, between being homeless and not.
Right.
So I don't know, you know, that, it's hard to say, well, what can you do, you know, about the family structure in our country.
We don't have a space. For example, we have in San Francisco, we have high-rise office buildings that are about 30% vacant office space, but we have all these thousands of people on the streets, which you're talking about, and that's because it was a tax advantage to build those before they changed the tax law. Let's see. Yes.
What did the mayors come up with? Did they come up with any plan of action for the homeless?
And they have some recommendations, but the cost is so high. Cities can't afford that kind of massive. They need federal money. They need money from the federal government, and the federal government is, well, they said we're getting out of it. The federal government said we're getting out of the business. The Reagan administration. You know, there were people in the Reagan administration who wanted to eliminate HUD, Housing and Urban Development, just eliminate the whole department, as they wanted to eliminate the Department of Education, the Department of Energy. They didn't.
Reagan was one of them.
Pardon me?
I said, you know, you're talking about people in the Reagan administration. Reagan was one of them.
Reagan was one of them, yes. Right. But you can't just blame it on the Reagan administration. Some of these things were back and forth. Yeah.
I'm wondering whether or not other cities have a program which is like the one which exists in Seattle, which I'll describe very briefly. Mm-hmm. It seems to make some sense. Our congregation at one point, the congregation which I'm a member at one point, thought that it was going to expand its facility. And the city grew around us more rapidly than we anticipated. We're not going to expand our facility. But in that process, we bought two homes, which we had slated for destruction in order to take care of the expansion. We've used one for the purpose of housing mentally ill people. That's easy in Seattle because there is a relatively secure program which provides some money for maintenance of the building and some staffing to take care of counseling of these people. So if we have someone whose problem becomes quite severe, there's always someone that we can call who's good at this counseling and who will show and take care of them. We've run quite a few people through that building on relatively short periods of time, and it seems that they are able to move from that sort of 6 months or so in residence with some help into situations which protect them. The other house that we have, we are trying to use for just blame unhoused families. That's much more difficult. Although the city does have a relatively small amount of money, which can be used to help us provide some things that are necessary. But it does not have any counseling services at all. And we find that with a moderate-sized congregation that it's difficult for us to counsel with these people, to see what they need, to provide them with groceries occasionally, and just the busy work that goes into it. It really is less a matter of money than it is of person hours available. Are those kinds of programs available, for example, in your home?
Oh, yes, they are. Now in San Francisco, there's families, there's always a place for families in hotels, and they have services available to them most of them are single parents with children. But the problem was that when there was this big, when the recession of 81, 82 hit, and there were all these homeless people, why the cities thought that it would be a temporary problem, and that when the economy caught up again, you know, which it has, why then these homeless people would disappear. Well, they haven't. They've increased. And what they realize now is that this is a permanent situation. It's not a temporary problem. But because city policy was attacking as a temporary problem, then they had temporary shelters. So they contract with hotels to house people in these emergency shelters, and they are just hell holes. I mean, they're just awful.
That's the reason why I was mentioning this. I realized that if we were only one congregation doing this, that's a relatively small number of people, but there are 110 Lutheran congregations in Seattle, including the immediate suburbs, and there are lots of houses available. I would agree with whoever it was that made the comment that could be purchased for relatively small amounts of money, and if the support is available, it's easy to do things by multiplication. I know you take 100 congregations and say if each congregation had a house or two.
Or it took one family.
Yes.
And then you take all the Catholic churches and the Baptist churches.
That's right. So multiplication is such a simple way to solve all these problems. But at least it's a program which seems to have some hope for success, because it offers people enough time and enough contact to be able to make contacts with their future before they leave.
But see, the problem is that that's fine as long as there is a kind of a static number. But the number is increasing geometrically at such a rate that there's no way that if every church in the country adopted a family, say a homeless family, that we could keep up, because they keep coming. And the problem is this whole thing of affordable housing.